Hi, I'm Michael Strahan, and join me for Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion, an oral history from the Players Tribune, powered by digital media. Relive the moment that shaped the 1986 Giants as told by the men who contributed to that legendary defense, Bill Parcells.
It puts these guys together forever, and that's never going to change because they're each other's guys, and there's only a few of them.
Harry Carson, Pepper Johnson, Elvis Patterson, George Martin, Leonard Marshall, Carl Banks, and of course, LT Lawrence Taylor.
Nobody played with us. We was absolutely dominant. It was like men playing with boys. Nobody played with us. You can smell it. You can feel it. We could do anything. Anything.
Subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so that you can get Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I'm just over here with buckets full of emails and DMs and Twitter mentions from our listeners. The mailbag is overflowing. We're going to get to all of that. I went to my first game in a while last night. The Warriors waxed the Clippers again. No Chris Paul. And I came away thinking that the Clippers should just go ahead and do it. Just go ahead and inject the Melo insanity into their lives. Maybe it won't work. It probably won't work, but might as well. Just watching these double-digit games kind of stack up in this kind of quote-unquote rivalry between these two teams to really feel like no matter how good Blake plays, and I actually thought he played pretty well in the last two games here against both Phoenix and Golden State. They're not even really competitive. They're just overgunned. I mean, the Golden State made it look so easy. I mean, why not do it? I mean, can't you kind of feel like this is getting stale a little bit and maybe they should just go ahead and pull the trigger?
Yeah, I mean, Golden State held out Draymond last night too, which almost felt like taunting because it was like, all right, yeah, sure, Blake, you can have a good game here and Draymond will see you in the playoffs. So that whole rivalry has gotten kind of uncomfortable to watch. It's like, it's too sad. I completely agree with you that it's time to sort of mix it up a little bit, and that's not a bad place to start. We got a question from a listener about Melo to the Clippers, so we'll move that up to number one. Rory asks, do you think the Clippers 2021 pick is being undervalued in a potential Melo trade? Not bad odds, it's in the lottery. And I'm glad he asked that because that's sort of is not getting enough attention. Like, as much as we want to make fun of Austin Rivers as the centerpiece of a trade, if I'm the Knicks, I feel like Phil Jackson is in a good spot to say, look, we'll give you Melo for all these spare parts, all due respect to Austin Rivers, but you're not going to get him without giving us some sort of future pick. And by 2021, the Clippers could very well be the Brooklyn Nets of the West Coast.
See, I was just going to say that if you go back 4 years and you look at some of the teams that were in the playoff picture 4 years ago, you have the Nets, the Knicks.
Exactly.
Know, you've got the Lakers were actually at the playoffs. I mean, you just go right down the list of these teams that kind of, you know, bounce up and down and the fortunes really swing hard over the course of a 4 year period. And
especially like any team that's stacked with veterans and is like loading up for one last shot is always a great candidate to steal a pick like 2 or 3 years down the road. Like that's why I kind of liked what the Suns did when they gave Goran Dragic to the Heat a couple years ago. Like, we'll take the 2019, 2020 pick and take our chances with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cute thing for the internet. Here's the problem, though. You know, if you're trying to put that into a Melo trade and making that like a real sweetener, good luck trying to sell that to Dolan. I mean, what does Dolan care about 2021? He's out there playing in his band, living for the night. You know, he's not thinking about 4 years from now in any way.
That's fair. Jimmy Dolan's living for the night.
And by the way, would Phil Jackson recognize the value of that pick? That's another question.
No, I don't think he would. But I just think that the rest of us, as we mock the potential returns for a Knicks trade, I think that everyone's kind of sleeping on that 2021 Clippers pick.
I think Rory is correct. And I think that the actual value of the Clippers pick is more than it's gotten credit for and far more than the Knicks are going to value it at. So that leaves you with this big shrug. Like, what does it even matter here if New York doesn't see it, you know?
If it's smart, it's entirely by accident, but it might end up being smart. So we'll see. And speaking of front offices and front offices who are not that smart, JDM asks, rank the NBA owner / front offices, starting with the worst. It's hard to pick among Chicago, New York, Sacramento, Lakers, Orlando. So did you come up with any answers here?
Well, this was perfectly timed. It's almost like this guy was reading our weekly topics, because we were putting out a roundtable on the biggest clown shows in the NBA. And a bunch of these teams are already picked by other SI writers. So I actually had to take the Suns, and you had just praised them about 30 seconds ago. And I was sitting over here shaking my head vociferously, because I think the Suns have got to be in the mix. When you look at teams who haven't made the playoffs since 2011, it's Phoenix, Minnesota, and Sacramento. And we always talk about Minnesota and Sacramento's playoff drought. We never talk about Phoenix's playoff drought. And then you look at the sheer diversity of their mistakes, like basically anything you could do wrong as a front office, they've done, whether it's, you know, angering players, chasing superstars in free agency that they had no shot at getting, overpaying veterans. I mean, just the list goes on and on. Collecting too many guys onto one team, handing Isaiah Thomas and building the Celtics into a contender single-handedly with one of the worst trades in a decade. You know, blowing a lottery pick on Alex Len, like every single possible type of mistake you could make, the Suns have made. And so I think that kind of makes them Orlando West. So to me right now, the worst is Orlando and Phoenix.
I was wondering where that comment came when you were like, yeah, it's cute for the internet. But I guess that's, you've been in Suns hate mode, and that's fair. I haven't really thought about the totality of all that, because even when you go back to trading Joe Johnson from those 7 seconds or less Suns teams, like they've had a bad run of just sort of cheaping out at the wrong moments. And then the rebuild has been poorly managed from the start.
So I've actually been a guy who hasn't been super high on Steve Nash, like from historical perspective. Like I kind of question the MVPs a little bit. But I think the best argument for Steve Nash's legacy is that he made the Suns really good for a long time. Like that shouldn't be undersold.
Yeah, it's incredible. My worst team, I wasn't considering owners as much here. I think if you consider owners along with clueless front offices, New Orleans has to be in the mix.
For sure, definitely. In terms of dysfunction, they're right at the top.
Yeah, like New Orleans and Orlando, and I like Chicago is too competent to be in the bottom three in the NBA because they do some things well. But man, like reading some of the Jimmy Butler stuff, did you hear Ryan Russillo explain what they did to Jimmy Butler like 2 years ago with his contract?
I did.
I mean, like I can't believe that they operate with that. I can't believe that they operate that way with players, with like good players who anyone could look at Jimmy Butler. You might not have seen that he was going to be a superstar, but like he was clearly going to be a factor for that team for like years to come. And you look at the way they have trashed like Luol Deng on the way out. They trashed and they also like Luol Deng. They wanted to, he had a spinal tap at one point and they wanted him to play, and like, Joakim Noah played hurt for years, and they've just trashed all these guys. The way they conduct business is shittier than almost anybody.
Yeah, they've got to be in the mix, and we've gone way too long without mentioning the Kings. Can we just, we've been over the Kings for, you know, months on this podcast. It really is hard to pick. His question's great.
As I thought through it, the Kings do deserve credit for not giving Boogie away stupidly over the last like 2 years or so.
I don't know about
like,
that.
I think a lot of people around the league expected them to get swindled for Boogie, and they thus far have avoided that mistake. Although there are currently rumors that they're trying to trade him for, or that the Suns are trying to steal Boogie for TJ Warren, Alex Len, and a first round pick, which would be amazing. If years of Boogie Cousins rumors ends with TJ Warren and Alex Len, like that's an issue. So Kings, I guess, are perpetually a contender for the top spot on this list.
Yeah, I mentioned Phoenix as a trade destination for Cousins a while ago. I thought they would actually give back something good. So maybe that trade rumor isn't quite, maybe that's one of those early ones, you know, early round trade rumors where you're kind of working up to your real offer. But it does include the most important centerpiece for Vlade, a European center. That's going to have to come back no matter who he trades Cousins for. What about the Nets? I mean, Prokhorov, he was damn near, he was probably the worst owner there for a solid 4 or 5 years. And now he's just in hiding.
Well, and the front office in the Nets, they are doing a pretty good job at finding like useful guys around the fringes. But obviously, I didn't consider owners as much, but Prokhorov definitely deserves consideration here because he set back the, because I don't, like a lot of people blame Billy King for that Nets trade, but I think that was like probably 75% Prokhorov prodding him to just do anything to make a splash.
Oh, I think it was 99%, and that was the one thing that Billy King did really well was explain that, look, I'm just the instrument here. Like this isn't really my plan. He got that out. Perception's so important in this conversation too, by the way, because like you were surprised that I put the Suns into that mix, and I think, I mean, he was sort of like DeMar came out of the gates with, you know, a lot of positive momentum. That's sort of what was the story of the Suns GM too, right? Like he had all these glowing profiles his first year. Everyone's really excited for this new era of Suns basketball, and they've fallen flat on their face. And kind of the same thing in Orlando too, like Rob Hennigan. Oh, we got this young upstart. You know, he's from the Thunder family. He's going to know all these great tricks for the salary cap. Like, how's that worked out? You got Jeff Green 4 years later and you haven't made the playoffs. Like to me, a lot of the discussion around the worst teams is slanted by big market coverage for sure, because so many more people care about the Bulls' dysfunction than the Suns' dysfunction. And then it's also, you know, the perception of the GM. And I think one of the smartest things that these GMs do is get out in front of it when they get hired to make sure that they set the narrative of who they are as people, so that everyone looks through that lens when we judge their moves, because it can really buy you years of time. You know, you've seen it all across the league.
Yeah, and maybe that's why I kind of give Ryan McDonough in Phoenix the benefit of the doubt, because I think that some of the stuff, I think that ownership in Phoenix deserves blame for some of the short-sighted moves that they've made, but maybe I'm wrong, and maybe that was just them reading the market wrong. The Isaiah trade really looks bad in retrospect.
No, they just misvalued. They just misvalued players. Like Isaiah, completely off. That happens. You look at Brandon Knight too.
Yeah. Well, and they brought in Isaiah Thomas which then screwed up the Bledsoe and Goran Dragic pairing, and then like Dragic was so unhappy that they had to trade him, and then I guess they just decided, all right, we have to trade Isaiah too, and it was like, it was one of those things where it all happened so quickly. It was like probably a 36-hour period where the Suns just lost their mind, that none of us really like processed how crazy it was at the time. Because I think, didn't they also give away the Lakers pick that weekend?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And they took on Brandon Knight, and his career's falling apart immediately. All I know is this. You know how they gave David Blatt a title ring, the Cavs did?
Yeah.
I think if Isaiah Thomas and the Celtics ever actually win a championship, McDonough's got to get a ring.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Because, yeah, I don't know, man. And he did come from the Celtics, so maybe he was just doing a solid for Danny Ainge.
Sleeper agent for Danny Ainge.
All right, so next, actually, do we have a consensus on the top three here?
Yeah, my consensus is that JDM's correct. It's impossible to rank these. They're all just different flavors of terrible. I think the most underrated terrible is Phoenix. Orlando would probably be my absolute worst right now.
We have another Orlando question later on, but yeah. I think Phoenix, good call on Phoenix. I didn't even consider them, but they are definitely in the mix and in the bottom three. Other end of the spectrum now. Tyler Long asks, will the Heat ever lose again? And then Rory Neer asks, is Dion Waiters the greatest player of all time? And Rohan from Bombay, would you rather have Dion Waiters on your team or Dwayne Wade right now?
Come on. Come on. Here, you go first, sir, because I'm just going to be depressing. Like, I don't think Waiters is good. I don't think Waiters is funny. I don't want him on my team. I definitely don't want to be the team that pays him long-term money. Look,
this is very on brand for you. Dion, I too am a little bit skeptical of Dion Waiters, but I think that's part of what makes this current 2-week streak so incredible. So I love it. And the Heat in general deserve a ton of credit. Rob Mahoney wrote about this week, and it's something that I've been like quietly before games when I'm talking to people and bitching about the Wizards bench, like at stadiums and stuff. I always point out the Heat as the team that like just nails those moves, those like little moves at the end of the roster where they get guys who just like know how to play really hard and are just solid. So I don't know if you want to include Dion Waiters in that category, but like Tyler Johnson, definitely in that category. James Johnson, Josh Richardson, Willie Reed, Wayne Ellington, like those dudes are solid. And so they deserve a lot of credit for just sort of nailing those little contracts and not making big mistakes as they try to fill out the roster.
You know, and I actually would include Dion Waiters with that. I mean, when they did land him, it made all the sense in the world. It was like, oh yeah, that's actually like a really good fit for a team in transition that needs, you know, some little punch at that spot after losing Wade. Like, it made sense. Now, it is funny that you could have a real conversation about Waiters versus Wade. I mean, as much as I've just been a wet blanket about Dion Waiters, I mean, Wade's...
I don't think there's any question, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough because, like, what do you want every night? You know, that's kind of part of it. And then, you know, Wade's leadership angle and the vet stuff, that kind of goes out the window pretty quickly when you look at the mess that he's stepped into there in Chicago. And it's clear, you know, he's not this, like, amazing, you know, unifier, you know, like the United Nations General Council of basketball players. Like, that's not really who he is. He's just kind of Jimmy Butler's buddy, and it's the two of them versus the world. So you got to kind of subtract some points, you know, from that standpoint. I don't know. I might actually take Waiters right now. As crazy as that makes me sound, please delete the audio of this podcast.
I mean, yeah, I'm definitely taking Waiters. Wade is now in like a weird spot, like where he's just kind of, he's openly bitter. Did you see him? I don't follow him on Twitter, but of course, Rohan, our coworker, retweeted it. He was lashing out at some Heat beat writer who was basically saying like Wade is past his prime. And I don't know. I like Wade carries himself like he's still elite, and he's just not. And I would not want to deal with it on a daily basis.
Yeah, I've actually changed my mind. There's no way I'm going to take Wade on my team just off of his transition defense alone. Like whatever Waiters does would aggravate me less than Wade doing the superstar thing after he doesn't get a call because he can't quite get to the same spot he used to get when he drives, and then he just lays around on the ground or barks at the official.
Exactly.
For like seven or 8 seconds.
In Chicago, they were complaining that he doesn't go to practice every day, which is like, obviously, that's fine. You're 36 years old. Like, however, during games, he's taking plays off, and then that's when it starts to get a little bit more complicated. So, we're both on Waiters Island here. That's great.
No, I'm not. I'll just say neither. I'll go neither. But if I had to pick one, I'd take Waiters.
Yeah. Well, shout out to the Heat for not paying. I think big picture, what the Heat are proving is that you can kind of, the best strategy is if you're not going to get the guys you want over the summer, then don't settle for like a B or a C plus answer that you have to overpay. There's a lot of guys who you can get on low risk deals, and it's impressive.
Well, the real one is just don't pay the golden parachute, you know, like it's going to work. It's going to work out a lot better for them than.
Well, and I'm also personally, I really feel like I would much rather root for the team that gives James Johnson a 1-year deal as opposed to the team that gives Jan Mahinmi like $65 million. So that's colored my view of the Heat all year long. And speaking of which, I'm not going to force you to endure too much Wizards talk, but we have three questions here.
Oh my God. Matt. Yeah, we've had three questions total. Now the next three questions are all going to be Wizards questions. This is what I'm talking about, yeah. Because I see all the questions that come in and then I see which ones that you pick. There's clear bias. This is my message to the NBA PR staff. Repeal and replace Sharp's vote on any of the awards. Because he also, I asked you for all your awards picks for a post I did this week, and you were naming every wizard for every single category. You had Thomas Satoransky for Rookie of the Year, and you actually had Scott Brooks for Coach of the Year, which I kind of stole and like put that into my column. But
did you really? All right.
I did. Well, thanks for reading. But this is just ridiculous. Look, man. We can't do three or four or five Wizards questions every single
week. You cannot deny the Wizards are one of the biggest stories in basketball right now. And I am not, I don't honestly even want to talk about it because I don't want to like screw up whatever's happening with the universe here. But Max Siegel asks, are the Wizards for real? And Peter Eisman asks, will the Wizards win the championship or just the East? Quick answers there. The Wizards are definitely for real. If they can stay healthy through May, the starters are like, I think that starting five has played more minutes together than any unit in the NBA. So it's a concern, but they are for real for now. And yeah, they're definitely winning the title, obviously. Have you not watched the last 2 weeks? James Sharp, no relation, but he asks, dear cousin Andrew and Ben, who's the one player reasonably available that our beloved Wizards could/should add? Can I run one idea by you?
Is it Carmelo Anthony again?
No, although some people hit me up on Twitter and were complaining about that idea. And I don't think people realize quite how good a closing lineup of Wall, Beal, Otto, Markieff Morris, and Carmelo Anthony could be. That's like approaching death lineup. I mean, it would be definitely like East Coast, a little bit more depressing version of the death lineup, but it would be fun.
The sound that you hear is Tristan Thompson getting 42 offensive rebounds in the fourth quarter.
I don't know. It's worth a try. If you can do it for Oubre, it's worth a try. So the other option, though, would be why don't the Wizards just give Denver a first round pick for Wilson Chandler, who was publicly complaining yesterday and wants out of Denver.
So this is like the trade, like you like the Markieff Morris trade, but you don't want to take on the baggage of his twin. Let's go out and make the exact same trade, but for Wilson Chandler, basically. Yeah.
Just another piece off the bench. Why not?
I'm with it. I like it. Wilson Chandler, through Sam Amick, made it very clear he wants out. I'm sure he's not the only person in Denver who's feeling that way, given the success of some of the younger guys there. You know, it does kind of seem like that's the direction they're going to go. They've been jerking his minutes around. He's been playing pretty well, too. Like, he should want out.
Yeah, he could help a contender, except most of the contenders who could use him don't really have assets to give up. You know what I mean? Like, I guess you could argue that Houston would make sense, too, for Wilson Chandler if they wanted to give up a pick or maybe one of their younger players, like Sam Decker. But we've been trying to get Wilson Chandler on the Clippers for several years now, and they don't have anything to give unless they want to give up that 2021 first.
Yeah, it's crazy that they can't swing a deal for Chandler, but they can put together the best package the Knicks are getting for Carmelo, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I don't know how we got here.
Poor Melo. No, but it's just because, you know, whether you want to take the money back or not. If I'm Denver, I probably don't want to take any money back, so that does make the Clippers a lot harder to deal with. So it would just be a first-round pick. Can they do that legally, or they have to send somebody back?
I think the Wizards would probably have to send it, like throw in a couple salary fillers, Marcus Thornton, but they could probably make it work. So that's my hope. That's my one player that they could add that's reasonable. Otherwise, there are not that many good options. But look, they're looking good. I have one other question here. Are the Zards becoming the edgy franchise? I don't really know what the edgy franchise means, but they say first the funeral game and now brutal troll on Nick Young by playing Iggy's music on his 3-point misses last night. I wasn't at the game, but I'm glad that happened. That's pretty hilarious.
I think that's below the belt. I think you shouldn't do that for former players, no matter how bad they are. I think you got to show them respect. Sorry.
Maybe that's true. Yeah.
This is just me checking in from the high horse. If it was just a random player, I think I would be okay with it. But he has been pretty outspoken about how much he doesn't like the Wizards. They had a really bad just era with him in town. Clearly, it wasn't just his fault. I mean, there's a lot going on. I just don't think you poke that particular bear. I think you let it lie and move forward and carry yourself a little bit higher class. I mean, that is personal. Like if somebody did that to LeBron, yeah. I mean, imagine the 7-minute tirade we would have gotten, you know?
I kind of feel like it's all in good fun, but I think that's a fair point that they do have a good relationship with Nick Young. Like I was at shoot around and he's still boys with like most of the Wizards staff. And side note, it was also pretty entertaining watching him. A couple DC people were trying to get him for an interview, and at one point he just ran out of the stadium, like up the aisles and out onto the concourse. So that was great. Always good to see Nick Young.
Yeah, he can probably feel the oppressive resentment. You know, that's probably what's going on.
I guess so. I was happy to see him. Next question. Muhammad asks, how far can the Raptors fall in the East standings if they keep playing like this? The Raptors are kind of like the inverse of the Wizards story. About a month into the season, everyone decided that they were the clear second best team in the league and that they were doing things the right way and everything was clicking. And now, I don't know, man, like the rotation looks thinner than it ever has. And there are just a lot of holes here. Like they've got to make a deal, right?
Yeah, you just kill me because you go to this like certain voice where you're trying to mock what people were saying about them to kind of like undercut the validity of it, which, you know, I actually appreciate that voice a lot, except that you were saying all the same words that you said seriously 3 weeks ago. You know, I mean, oh, they're clear cut number. See, some of us who have been Raptor skeptics from the start are sitting around, you know, quietly saying, I told you so.
Maybe quietly sipping your tea.
Maybe it's not quite the best plan to roll Kyle Lowry out there for 90 minutes in a back-to-back. Maybe it's not the best plan to have your entire offense structured around the greatest all-star in NBA history, DeMar DeRozan. Maybe you should try to trade for a power forward at any point. Probably Jared Sollinger is not going to be the answer. I mean, this team has been kind of flawed the whole way. And they were...
So...
I don't know. I think they honestly forgot, again, that the season's a marathon. I mean, Dwayne, if there's one knock on Dwayne, it's that he runs his main guys into the ground.
Yeah, I think that's the reason I would be most concerned if I were a Raptors fan. Like, if I actually looked up their next five games. They were at Orlando tonight. They're at Brooklyn Sunday. Home versus the Clippers, at the Bulls, at the Wolves. I think they can probably go 4-1 through that stretch, if not 3-2. So like there's certainly they can win at Orlando and at Brooklyn tonight and should win those games. So they will be able to right the ship short term, but I would be most freaked out that they are kind of like leveling off here and Kyle Lowry hasn't even broken down yet. Like they've been playing Lowry to a degree that like I just don't know how you can expect him to keep doing this for 8 months straight, right?
No, he is playing too much. There's no question about it. Yeah, I don't know. To answer the question, how far can they fall? I mean, do you really see a scenario where they drop to like fifth? I mean, I don't think that they would go below Indiana and Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of these teams I'm still very skeptical of, but I guess their worst case is probably fifth, right?
I think that the reason they won't fall that much further is because the rest of the East is pretty terrible. So like, I think that the Raptors are going to have a pretty underwhelming final 40 games or whatever we've got here. But I also think that like the Hawks are going to have a couple bad weeks. The Pacers are going to be up and down until April. So they're not going to fall lower than fifth probably, but it's not encouraging when you think back to how, And you're right. I was definitely one of the people who were like, look, give the Raptors credit, but
You were telling me that DeMar was going to average 36 points a game all season, lead the league in scoring.
Every time you say that, the number you claim I said gets bigger. I said he was going to average like 28 a game, 28 or 30.
No.
And he's like probably right around there.
I said under 28. You said at least 31, but we'll move on.
Trey Rowland asks, you've just been hired as the GM of the Orlando Magic. Besides weeping uncontrollably, what else do you do? So the Magic are so screwed up that I think the only thing you can do is to just get rid of just about everybody. Like, I would blow it up hard. Like, trade Ibaka right now for whatever you can get. Even if it's like a crappy pick from the Raptors, just give him to Toronto. Trade Elfrid Payton. Trade Evan Fournier. I think the only two guys on that roster that I would really want to keep is Bismack Biyombo and then Aaron Gordon.
Okay, so you're thinking about this a little bit too X's and O's in terms of the roster. We got to do one step before that. I mean, Magic fans have really suffered here for a long time. Hennigan's got them all twisted up, not knowing if they're trying to win or rebuilding or whatever. So you're going to have to win the press conference. Your first move is going to be to call the press conference. You're going to offer like dollar season tickets to get way out in front on the fan sympathy side, because you're going to have to blow it up basically no matter what. Like, that is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's going to require another 3 or 4 years of patience. And every player that Hennigan has been selling to the public for the last 3 or 4 years that he hasn't already traded off for pennies on the dollar is probably going to have to go, besides maybe Aaron Gordon. So
totally. And that's the thing.
Your first move is going to have to be to completely throw him under the bus and just really lay out how poor of a job he did, while also giving fans a reason to stay tuned, giving them this season ticket deal. Once you do that,
that's fair.
You can trade everybody. That would be how I'd handle it.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the only option, because the pieces are just so awkward and they've been locked in this sort of limbo for 5 years now. You just got to get rid of everybody and start over. And
I would also hope that's what they do. I would also commission a profile, if possible, of being like, he's Hinkie's intelligence with a little more street smart. Like, I try to like have that be the angle.
Hinkie with better relationships. This is actually the team that I think would have the best case for signing Sam Hinkie.
Yeah, we've said that before, and it's true. I mean, I would say, I don't know if there's almost any former executive who could do worse than what they've had.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Well, this dovetails nicely into the next question. Book Wormington asks, if you're a rebuilding GM, apart from trading for 5 bucket getters, would you tank Philly style or be a 7-8 playoff seed? And so my answer in terms of just like rebuilding theory, which we're all such nerds about this, but I do really have like takes on this. If you've got nobody who you think can eventually be part of like a contender, then you have to tank. And that's Orlando here, obviously. And if you've got 1 to 2 like young potential superstars who will get there eventually, then you try to win and you try to get the 8th seed, because I feel like winning and compete and playing games that matter really does make a difference. Like, that's a real thing. But you have to be careful, because there's a big difference between like the Wizards traded a first round pick to get Marchand Gortat, to help John Wall and to give John Wall and Bradley Beal some help. And I think that really made a big difference. But there's a difference between doing that and doing like the Pelicans went out and just went all in on Tyreke Evans for like 5 years. And that's where you start to get into trouble. So I would try to make low risk moves to get that 7th or 8th seed. And then I think tanking is most valuable of all when you have superstars. Like, if I were the Blazers or if I were the Bulls, with Jimmy Butler and Damian Lillard, like, look around, realize that you're not going to do anything if you get to the 8th spot, and just bottom out like that. I don't understand why these almost good teams don't like tank hard through the second half of these seasons.
Yeah, I think it's just a pushback, and both from ownership and the fan bases here. Let me loop in another question here real quick from Nicholas Nocetti. He wants to know, is it possible you get a situation where you have too many young players to realistically develop simultaneously? He mentioned the Nuggets because they've got Malik Beasley, Moutier, Hernan Gomez, Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic, and Nurkic. I mean, is there a situation, and maybe that's what's happening in Orlando too, or maybe not, where they just have so many young guys all competing for those developmental minutes that it's kind of holds any of them back from being who he really could be?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I wonder about with the Nuggets pretty often. Like Malik Beasley, I think could be good. He's a draft pick that I really liked in last year's draft, but it's hard to see how he gets minutes on that team. And you could say that like Hernan Gomez, I think, would look good if he were featured more often. So the question is like, what's the real value of flipping like three or four of those guys? You know what I mean? Like, I guess like the Celtics actually went through this a couple years ago, and you could argue are going through it now, where they have a lot of young guys especially leading up to the KG trade, they had a lot of young guys who looked like they could turn into something, but weren't actually like they would never be real factors. So I think you have to just be clear-eyed about that. And if I were the Nuggets, I would be working hard to trick someone into thinking that like two or three of those guys are worth a star.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it does kind of seem like from what you said earlier about tanking and then also what you just said, I mean, is there, you're trying to kind of get to a core of maybe like two or three guys who you're really building around. And until you have that group, you keep tanking. Once you get them, you go forward. Is that your basic strategy?
Yeah. Well, I basically think you want a guy like Nikola Jokic, and I guess you could argue that Murray maybe has some of that same potential. And then like, so there was another question that we got. Should any team in the West be actually trying to win the eighth seed right now? And if you look up and down the West, like it's hard. I think that it makes a lot more sense for the Nuggets to push for that eighth seed, to get that experience for the younger guys that they have, than it would for like Portland is a team that I don't see it.
Yeah, I think Portland's got to do it just because they're already like in, you know, they're bluffing, like they're in the pot and they've bluffed and they're not good, but they just have to kind of go for it, you know, and they would rather have, I think, in Portland, an ugly first round series with the Warriors. So they can at least save a little face. It's not this like complete, you know, two steps back from the second round all the way to the lottery situation. So I'm sure they're going to keep going for it, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea. I'm just saying that's going to be their mentality.
Yeah, and you know that team and that mentality better than I do. But you look at the West right now, they would have to tank pretty hard to get it down to like Suns level, but they're only six games ahead of the Suns, 22 and 28. They could do it if they wanted to, and I think put them in the top five, top six in this draft, and I don't think you tank because like Justin Jackson from Kansas is going to make them a whole different team, but you can then trade that pick.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I would always rather tank than be stuck in the middle to answer the original question. It's just a tough sell to everybody because all the hopes were raised and you have to admit defeat. And then if you do admit defeat, Neil O'Shea has to do that. And now Paul Allen, the owner, is going to say, well, why are you admitting defeat like 6 months after we just paid all of these players? It's time for you to go. You know, it's just very hard to course correct that hard within the same season. You know, you rarely see that from a front office, which is probably a reason why, you know, it's probably a pretty common mistake for front offices to make, not getting out of bad decisions as quickly as possible. But I would be shocked if they really went that route, barring an injury to somebody.
So one more question here. What about the Nuggets making the playoffs? Do you agree with that?
It's tough because I think the best thing would be just to maximize their draft pick assets still because they're so young. They don't have the pressure from the local fan base because people don't really care about them. And they are kind of riding the high of like, Jokic is really fun. Let's just go with it. Yeah. I think that they're in a situation where they should continue competing as long as possible. If they start to slip out of the race just naturally, let's say early April, then shut everybody down, try to improve the draft pick a few slots and play for next year. But I think like all these teams weirdly have kind of like the internal need for validation of making the playoffs, even though it's not that amazing from the outside. Like Sacramento would freaking kill for it. Portland, Portland could really use it. And I think Denver, like, you know, they could too. I mean, they were celebrating when Tim Connelly, their GM, got his first 100 wins, and it took him like 3 years to get there. Like, they would be very excited with an ugly 8-seed playoff spot, no question.
I think Sacramento is definitely the team that would read way too much into the playoffs success. Like, of all those teams, you're right that Denver would treat it like winning a title also, but like, I could see Vivek giving Vlade like a lifetime deal after stealing the 8-seed at like, because whoever makes it to the playoffs is probably going to have like 38 wins.
What I'm hoping for actually is that we get our first strategic rest from the Warriors during the first round of the playoffs. Like, they really start taking the Spurs strategy like, to a new level, and they only play like two of their stars in game one, and then they rotate them and play the
Pat
other two
McCaw
in game two.
Starting a playoff game. Yeah,
easily.
I think it's definitely something that we're going to be like, it'll be a Pat McCaw running pick and rolls with JaVale McGee by the end of the Warriors first round series.
What I do think, though, for Denver, I think they're the of those three teams, they're the one that needs to be in the playoffs the least. And they also have the most flexibility at the deadline in terms of potentially being buyers or sellers. So if they do decide that they get some amazing trade packages for whether it's like Gallo or Chandler or these other guys, and they don't make the playoffs, that's not the end of the world. Sacramento and Portland, I think that they're pretty much like headed straight for that brick wall. Like, they're going to try to do it no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. All right, let's run through a couple quick questions here. Steve Kraska asks, who would you still take before Brogdon from this draft? And TJ Bride asks, how old is Thonmaker? Is it safe to get excited about his future with the Bucks? I come to you again as the guy who gave them an F. I think Thonmaker has looked good, but I wouldn't get that excited.
And we don't need to joke about his age in this climate. We're good.
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. I think he's fine, and I would still take Thonmaker before Brogdon, for example, because he does have like a higher upside. I'm just not sure he'll get there. And Brogdon, I think, is great as like a pick in the 20s, and the Bucks were awesome for getting him in the second round. But I think top half of that draft, you still like want to roll the dice. And Brogdon, the hype might be getting a little out of control if people are starting to think about him as like a lottery type guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key contrast here is like Murray versus Brogdon, right? Like, look at the ages, look at the ceilings. Like, who are you really going to want for the next 10 years? If Murray is right now is 4 years younger than Brogdon, and he's showing he can play real minutes for a quality team, and Brogdon is kind of showing out for a mediocre Milwaukee team, and he's 4 years older. I mean, it's, to me, there's like no contest. So if you're going to take a guy like Murray, who was a late first round pick, as a long-term guy over Brogdon, then Brogdon might be in that 25 to 30 range, but nothing more.
Yeah, it's weird. I feel like this happens a lot with guys who sort of come out of nowhere and surprise people. Like, I love Malcolm Brogdon, loved him before last year's draft. And the same type of deal is happening with Norman Powell with the Raptors, where like those teams then start like overvaluing them. And like Norm Powell, I guess people have said is untouchable with some of these Raptors trades. And that makes no sense to me. Like, they are good, useful players who are not going to like be the difference between making it to the second round or the first round or missing the playoffs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I really like Norm Powell. But I generally agree. The reason why he's untouchable is just the contract. I mean, he's so dirt cheap, and he can give you starter quality minutes as a, you know, 3-and-D type guy. And if you're doing that for less than $1 million, I mean, that's a really hard trade asset to move. But no, he's not like a building block superstar player. Like, oh, we've got to put him on the untouchable pile. But I mean,
to me, I think the all-time example. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, this is kind of a hot take, but I don't think that they look that much worse when he plays DeMar's minutes. You know, like I think they're kind of.
And that's, I think I totally agree with you. Like that is a hot take, but.
So I'm just saying, like, which one of those
to keep him?
So here, the casual fan will say DeMar is the untouchable one of those two, right? Because he's the all-star, he's the starter, he's proven it. To me, by far, the better trade value asset as an organization is Powell on his contract compared to DeMar on his contract. That's probably like too nerdy and basketball internet-y of me to even say that, but that's how I look at it.
My response would be that, like, if I understand if you're going to make DeRozan available, then definitely keep Powell at all costs. But if the plan is to build around DeRozan, then like Norm Powell is not going to make or break anything. And the all-time example of this for me is like there were 9 months when the Knicks just were refusing any sort of Iman Shumpert discussions because he had like a good couple of months after coming out of nowhere from Georgia Tech. And that looked really, really ridiculous like 2 years later. So I feel like it's just something to be aware of as people get overvalued. Next question though, Jordan said, do you remember this dude from the Celtics mailbag?
You mean the woman from New Zealand?
Yeah, he said, female from New Zealand, I'm a male from Australia, but play on. Thanks for the answer. Love the show.
Jordan, there's no way I screwed that up myself. Okay, I'm throwing that all on Sharp. That's Sharp's fault.
That's entirely my bad. In my defense, it's Jordan with a Y, which is a little bit gender ambiguous.
Oh,
and
my
then
God.
At the
you're
same
gonna
time,
call this you're gonna call this guy out who takes the time to send you an email.
No,
you don't like the spelling of his name? Jordan, I'm with you. Team Jordan.
Yeah, and our relations with Australia are a little bit delicate this week, so we got to tread carefully. But also, in emoji form, when you're just like looking at the phone, Australia's flag and New Zealand's flag are incredibly similar. So that's my defense, but I think the real takeaway is that I'm an idiot. And He asked the same question that Faoud asks, which is basically, with the amount of minutes Sheriff LeBron is playing this season, is it at all possible he completely wears out and the Cavs are beatable in the Eastern Conference playoffs? What do you think?
I mean, it's insane what Ty Lue's doing. I'm going to keep saying that. You're going to keep telling me LeBron really wants to run himself into the ground, and I'm going to completely disagree with you again. I think it's possible, but not likely. I don't think it's that possible. My thinking is very colored by his run through the playoffs 2 years ago, which was basically as burdensome as it could ever get. And he's still kind of, made it through. There are a couple of teams, though, that have these sneaky good offenses. Like when they're really rolling, they're rolling. Boston, mm-hmm. Boston for sure. Toronto, I think Toronto's offense would fold in the playoffs, but you can see some of them just like catching, lightning in a bottle and going with it. Actually, same thing with the Wizards, to be honest. I mean, maybe their offensive ceiling isn't as high, but, if Beal and Porter are just like raining threes, I mean, that could get to be a tough situation. But I don't know. I'm not quite ready to go there with the Cavs fear mongering yet.
But wouldn't you like, I think I picked the Celtics in an upset in October. And when I did that, I would have said there's only like a 5-10% chance that this actually happens. Now I think there's a 20% chance that the Cavs don't make it back to the finals, because this is all before any like they haven't had any serious injuries. So there's always a chance that one of the big three gets hurt. And I don't know, man, it just feels weird. I think we've all been so careful about not concern trolling the Cavs this year that like, especially because I mean, we've learned our lesson after the last 2 years, but the vibes are not great. And I don't know.
Well, we're also forgetting though, that they are the East number one seed. There's been many seasons where there's been either better competition in the East, so they didn't get the number one seed, or they've just relaxed more and didn't get the number one seed. And there's never really been an issue. So home court's not a huge deal. And even by like LeBron standards during this run, when you look at their record, it's one of the more successful records he's had over the last seven seasons. I mean, it's not as good as the peak in Miami, but like you still got to give him credit for that. And I still don't see anyone really who matches up that well with him, whether it's Washington, Boston, or Toronto. So I'm still giving him every possible benefit of the doubt in those hypothetical series. Now, I do think like there is a path where it gets really, really tough for him if you just construct it with like the very best possible individual matchups against him. Like if they were to have to go through Chicago in the first round and Jimmy just wears him down somehow. And then you go and I don't know, who do you think the toughest second round matchup would be for him? Washington?
Yeah, I think Washington, even I think Washington would be tougher than Toronto. Let's say Washington.
Okay, so let's give him first Jimmy in the first round, then Washington in a tough second round series, and then Boston, you know, and then maybe in games like 5, 6, and 7 of the Boston series, their offense just catches fire. Like that is a scenario I could see, but these are a lot of ifs. You know, there's also a possibility that Cleveland goes, you know, 12-2 through the East and we're laughing about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's not only is a possibility, that's probably the more likely scenario. I would just say that it's crazy how much faith we've had in the Cavs almost the entire year and how there's like real doubt now. Not like it's still, they're still the clear favorites, but I think honestly, I would feel more comfortable if LeBron announced he was taking off the next month and then coming back for the playoffs.
They really should.
So, all right, next question. Sean asks, I spent the last 6 months researching and writing a 65-page legal article about the impending NBA lockout, citing to Sharp numerous times. Shout out to you, Sean. Given that there will be no lockout, we halted publication. Do you have a favorite article or article idea that you never got to finish because of a change in events? What's your take?
Well, I actually do this a lot for tweets where I'll have tweets written and ready to go right for the end of games. And then someone will do something right at the end. Like I remember there was one and the Warriors were going to have like the best point differential ever through however many games. Right. And I was like, ready, this is going to be a hot stat tweet. This is going to be great. And then they're winning.
I just love that because one of the best parts of becoming friends with you has been getting the like nerdy Golliver stats like early in the third quarter. As you wait for the all of it to happen.
No, I'm prepping them and just sitting here sweating and just like hoping it holds up. But like sometimes
I hope the Warriors finish this game.
No, so that's the thing. I'll need the Warriors to like win by like 37 or more to make the stat work. And then like they'll be playing like the Clippers. Like most Spates will hit like a garbage three with like 4 seconds left that cuts the lead to 36. So it ruins the stat. And I'll just like get up and like throw a pen against the wall. Like, dang it, God, you know, I'll just be so frustrated. That happens to me a lot. I probably shouldn't admit that publicly. In terms of the other stories that you haven't gotten a chance to write, well, Greg Oden's entire career, I think that would be the top. You know, I think there was a lot of people in that Portland, area back in 2008 who were thinking this guy's the meal ticket. You know, people are probably thinking about book deals and Blazers are going to be contenders for 10, 15 years. And that story went real sideways. How about you?
So wait, just to clarify, do you think you would still be in Portland if Greg Oden had panned out?
That's a crazy.
There's like a whole alternate timeline for your life.
I mean, I think probably, yeah. Why not? I mean,
yeah.
Like if they're the center of, I think probably there would have been like, what was the heat index? You know, it'd be the Blazers in Blazers index.
The Blaze index, yeah,
yeah. I mean, think about how many writers are going to converge on Portland, one of America's most livable and affordable cities, to follow like five straight finals appearances by the Greg Oden led Blazers. I think that would be the nexus of basketball.
Yeah, Otto Porter is that meal ticket for me here in DC. I would say. I don't really, this was a hard one to answer. You were kind of like, I would say most of the things that I haven't published, whether it's because of timing or an editor being like, we should chill. Like most of those decisions have wound up looking great in hindsight. So generally, I don't have many like regrets. The one thing I thought of was when I was at Grantland, I wrote hot sports takes every week, which is like mocking columnists and hot takes. And after LeBron cramped up in the finals, I wrote a hot sports takes open letter to LeBron, upset that he had let the troops down right after Memorial Day. And there at the time, there were like all these memes about how like how soldiers can fight through the heat, but LeBron can't. And so I weaved that in, and that would have been like a scathing, scathing hot take. And it was actually too much, and we decided not to run it. So that was a regret. But other than that, most of the time when people say, let's wait this out or whatever, I'm pretty happy with it.
Wow. I am offended just by the description of that column. I didn't even read it.
It was so, because it was also like there were already a lot of people calling out, basically calling LeBron a coward that day. And I was just going to parachute in like Friday afternoon. But, you know, and yeah, I don't know. It would have been great. It would definitely be something that I would find hilarious now and probably would have like caused a war on the internet back then.
Hey, one serious thing on this question, though, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but one advantage of being a writer online is that there's the salvage is always in play. You know what I mean? Like, rarely does something just get completely fried, at least for me. Like, you can always find a way to kind of spin it or rework it or whatever. That is one advantage of not being on like the magazine life where, you know, if you're working on a story for 2 months and then the guy gets injured, that's just never, that's spiked. Like, that's never coming back from the death, right?
That's a really good point. That's like a stress that I don't know how the SI magazine people deal with. Like it just, cause I think the last person who had it happen was, remember Lee Jenkins's Rondo profile?
I do.
I think Rondo blew out his ACL like before that ran, which had to have hurt. And thankfully it was by Lee Jenkins. So it was still like the best thing anyone had ever read on Rondo. But like, I think that's the type of stuff that you're talking about, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, they get it the worst from all angles because you could write something and then, as soon as it hits, you know, within 2 weeks, like it looks completely wrong and you don't have the ability to sort of like put it into context. I mean, it's a much firmer, piece. So yeah, they've got all sorts of stresses, whether it's the, like praying that the story holds up or, you know, you don't look bad because of the Lakers cover or all these other things that they've got going on.
The Lakers cover was so, so good. All right. Three more questions here. All personal memories and Britt says, what's the most memorable game you went to in person? This is a real female listener, by the way.
Yes. I'm not going to say she doesn't count, but I do know her. So like, it's not like,
it's not. All right, so she may not count. It's
no,
fine.
I mean, she counts like, you know, in a different way, but like, we're still trying to expand our active female listenership. Please people, like our graphs that we get are like 98% male. I mean, some of you guys, come on, help us out.
We have yet, my wife does not listen to the podcast. So maybe one day we'll crack into that demographic.
Well, she probably kept hearing that I could say that she could take like Isaiah Thomas off the dribble like three podcasts in a row. And she's like, all right, we're not going to listen to that anymore. The most memorable game, game 7 of last year's finals has got to be way up there. Game 6 of the 2013 finals. One of the most memorable games actually for me was the Western Conference Finals last year in Oklahoma City, Game 6, where they just melted down because of the fan reaction. I've never seen a fan base take a loss harder than that Game 6 loss in Oklahoma City.
Don't act like that's surprising. Like as that happened, I was insanely jealous that you got to be there for that game. That should be at the top of your list.
Yeah, you know, another one that's randomly up there. Remember Derrick Rose hit that 3-point game winner to beat the Cavs and then just like did like the stone face as everybody was mobbing him in Chicago. And so for like a solid 14 minutes, everybody was convinced that Rose was back and like the Bulls were going to be good. That was a pretty crazy game to be at. But my big picture answer to this question is I usually remember the press conferences and the interactions after the games more than I actually remember the games. And so my favorite, most memorable game is LeBron throwing Blatt under the bus. That press conference was one of the most incredible experiences of my life when he's talking about how he's just going to take he's going to take the play and just like throw it in the garbage can. We're going to chuck that. That, I don't know if I've ever been more gleeful than after that press conference, because
Wait a second. Didn't Blatt then come out and compare himself to a fighter pilot making decisions on the fly?
I don't think that was it was the same general time period, but it wasn't the same night. But Blatt came out first. Okay. Which was also, you know, kind of unusual. Blatt comes out first and gives his side of the story. Doesn't mention anything about LeBron completely screwing his play over. LeBron comes out, clearly probably watched Blatt or heard what Blatt said. And it was like, no, no, here's the real facts. And then he just like just undresses his coach in public. I mean, just for sheer just like eye popping, just like what is happening, that will stick in my memory forever.
I'm insanely jealous of like a handful of different experiences that you've had basketball wise. My answer would be Wizards Cavs in 2006.
Oh, throwback.
Yeah, that was definitely, because I'm speaking more as a fan, because most of the time when I go to games as like a reporter, I don't remember the game that much for some of the reasons that you said, except that I don't think back like nostalgically about the press conferences the way you do. So I will go with, as a fan, Wizards Cavs in 06 was just incredible. Gilbert Arenas hit a 30-foot shot to send it to OT. And then I forget, I think it might have been Damon Jones hit a game-winning three after Gilbert Arenas missed free throws. It's definitely the most heartbroken I've ever been as a basketball fan, but it was like right up there as far as experiences. And then beyond that, I would say LSU Alabama in Death Valley was probably the most fun I've ever had at a sporting event.
Damn.
So going outside the NBA. But the next question is sort of related. Well, if you could use a time machine.
Hold on 1 second. I'm going to lose my Portland card if I don't mention Lillard's three-pointer against the Rockets. That was...
Oh my God. See, that's another one. I would kill to have been in that stadium.
That was an unbelievable game. And it was an out-of-body experience, really, because I knew the Rockets had given the Blazers too much time. I just had this like distinct sensation that they screwed that up. They scored too early to set that play up. I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I was like, and I don't usually have those kinds of premonitions. So I actually videotaped the shot from my seat and then like panned the crowd. And like the crowd reaction obviously is insane. Everyone's seen the shot from the courtside. Like that's unbelievable video that went viral, but like there's people like hugging, crying, like falling, tripping down the stairs. Like that was a pretty nutty game. And it was just a fun game to write about too, because, you know, Portland had so much trouble in the playoffs for, you know, the previous 14 years and kind of have it go that way. So that one, very, very memorable as well.
Yeah, that was the best first round of the playoffs that we've probably ever had. It was just a wild 2 weeks across the NBA and punctuated by the Lillard shot. I feel like that sort of captured everything. So next question, if you could use a time machine, this is from Adam, who sent us like a batch of great questions. If you could use a time machine to go back and witness any event in NBA history, what would it be? With due respect to Clay going nuts last year and the Mavericks winning the finals and Lillard and all the other shit that you've done that has made me jealous, the obvious answer here is being in the stands at Malice at the Palace.
See, that's funny that you said that, because I was going to go good angel, bad angel. Because like the good angel on my left shoulder was saying, go see Mike hit the jumper against Brian Russell. And, you know, the little shove.
That's true.
That was a good angel. And the bad angel was just screaming, go for the death. Like, go see Ron Artest get suspended for like 9 years.
My argument for that is basically that I'm going to be able to see awesome basketball and great endings for like fit the next 50 years, but I'm not going to be able to see an all-out riot at an NBA game ever again.
Well, they're actually kind of lucky, the NBA is, that that happened kind of before the internet was really where it is today. Because can you imagine, like, if I was at that game, my file from that game would probably be 7,000 words of interviews with fans and players and, like, descriptions. Yeah, I can't even, I would be up until 7 a.m. writing that piece that night. You know what I mean? And getting all these, you know, this guy hit me in the face. No, this guy hit me. Like, the fact that the real coverage, I mean, the video spoke for itself. So they kind of had to live with the video. But they didn't have, like, all these firsthand accounts that I remember anyways from the arena to, like, really, you know, make it even worse.
It's a great point. Thinking about the number of, like, overwrought think pieces that we would be inundated with in the wake of Malice at the Palace today is, like, it's too much for me to handle. And not only that, and then, like, the divisive politicization of that whole thing, like, it just would have been awful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just picturing myself, like, chasing after somebody, like, I saw you get punched by Jermaine. What was that like? You know, like, that...
Yeah,
I just feel like that could have gone so many different directions. And then, yeah, it would have spawned the huge backlash, which would have spawned the backlash to the backlash. Twitter would have hated itself. So
maybe all of culture needs to take the time machine back to 2005 and the year of Malice at the Palace. Maybe things peaked in the Malice at the Palace era. Maybe that's the takeaway.
You know, but, another one I'd like to see, though. Remember, like, rookie what? Magic in the finals? That would have been pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. There's a lot of good options for, like, way back in the day. Because some of the Celtics-Lakers finals would have been amazing, too. Where, like, Boston Garden was, like, 100 degrees and everybody was just going insane even before, like, opening tip. Like, that would have been fun. So
another one that I would have loved to be at would have been when the Bulls eliminated the Pistons and they didn't handshake. I would have loved to get on my high horse about the Pistons not shaking hands.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you read the columns from them, a lot of people did. Like, a lot of famous, like, still personalities who are still around today, like 25 years later, were so mad about the no handshakes. So that would have been a fun one.
Yeah. Well, it is pretty funny to think back on how universally disliked Isaiah Thomas was by the end of his years in the league. But last question here. And Adam asks, what's one unpopular NBA opinion that you firmly believe? I came up with a couple, but you can go. I'll let you start.
No. You go first.
Okay. Well, as we discussed earlier in the week, I still think Charles Barkley is pretty delightful, which I guess has become an unpopular opinion at this point. But he's entertaining and I'm cool with Chuck forever. Another one. Almost every coach in the league is equally good, and a lot of the arguing we do over these guys is just a complete waste of time. Like, I don't think that there's that much of a difference between Scott Brooks and Steve Clifford or whoever. I think that you get differences. There are certain coaches who are, like, obviously terrible, and then there are certain coaches who are excellent, like Brad Stevens, Rick Carlisle. I guess one unpopular opinion is that in-game, Greg Popovich might be a little bit overrated. But basically, beyond the bottom five and the top five, all coaches are equally good.
I think my most unpopular opinion is one that I've expressed before. What drives me crazy are these MVP candidates that are not even close to being in the MVP conversation. And really, the idea that because you're a new, fresh face and you score a lot of points, that makes you an MVP candidate. And I just react.
I want to commend you. Yeah. I want to commend you for the amount of restraint that you've shown with Isaiah Thomas's MVP buzz over the last two or three weeks. Because, like, I know in your heart you want to hijack the podcast and talk about his defensive real plus minus for 30 minutes every week, and you haven't. So I appreciate that. I think you're right that guys get, like, it's ridiculous, like, that he's in the mix.
Like, they're dead serious about it. And so were people about DeRozan early in the season. It's like, that's not what the game's about at all. And here's another thing with Isaiah specifically. Everyone's citing these amazing fourth quarter statistics. You know, here's a statistic for you. They're 1-7 against the good teams in the league. They finally got their first win against Toronto, right? If you have that poor of a record against the other best teams in the league, how can you possibly conceive of an argument where that player is the MVP when those other teams also obviously are going to have star players? It's just incomprehensible to me. You know what I mean? So that is my unpopular opinion. And sorry, Celtics Nation. He's great. He's been awesome. Like, it's really fun to watch. But I think my unpopular opinion is that what's fun to watch is not necessarily the most valuable. And I realize that pretty much is the definition of a hater, but that's fine.
Okay. Apart from my first, Adam only asked for one unpopular opinion, but I have a couple more. Apart from Charles Barkley is cool and most coaches are about the same. The Cavs should trade Kevin Love right now. And I don't know who they would get for him, but they should really think hard about his value is higher because he's going to get exposed by the Warriors again in June. And I don't think that he would have the same value then. So it's at least something that they should think about. Like a lot of these mellow conversations lead to Cavs fans being like, it's unthinkable that we would trade Love. Like, he's not that good and hasn't been that good against the one team that they're competing against. So I'm not sure why he's off limits. I understand Steph.
Hold on. Yeah, I was going to say, you're not going to give him credit for saving the entire finals with an unbelievable defensive performance against Steph Curry?
Yeah, I mean, come on, man. Are you being sarcastic saying that?
I'm just kind of messing with you. I'm doing that fake voice you were doing earlier when you were trying to
call up the
masses.
I don't think it's something the Cavs should think about.
Yeah, that's unpopular.
Maybe the right deal might not be there, but it's something that they should think about. Moving on. The last one. Russell Westbrook is the most overrated player in basketball.
Oh, God, dude. This is one of your unpopular opinions?
Yeah.
And you just buried it 75 minutes deep in this taping session?
It's actually not really my brand to be skeptical of Russell Westbrook, but and I appreciate Russ for what he is. I just think he has to win on his terms, and his terms sort of hurt the rest of the team.
So you're saying
the MVP candidates, he's the most ridiculous. He ran off Kevin Durant. Like, are we not going to acknowledge that happened?
Wow. Okay, slow down for 1 second. When you're saying overrated, what do you think most people are rating him as? Like, where is he in the pecking order?
I see a lot of people call him a top five player in the league. And that happened last year.
He's a top five
over the summer.
He's definitely
a top five. He's an atrocious defender. If you want to talk about Isaiah Thomas's defense and not talk about Westbrook's defense, I don't know what to tell you. Because he is just as bad.
And he stat chases, and he can't.
And like his meltdowns, particularly at the end of games in against good teams, like every Thunder playoff run ends the same way with Russ making inexplicable, indefensible decisions. So all I'm saying is that he's good, but he is not like, and it's actually, he's been overrated for a long time because the Thunder chose Westbrook over Harden and that didn't make sense at the time. So it's just something to think about.
What's amazing about this rhetorical device you've just used is you've spun my own logic back on me, and I'm having a really hard time coming back because I literally just said that the most entertaining is not the most valuable. And Westbrook's a great example of that because he's far more entertaining to watch especially when he's on, than maybe his total value would be. But still, I mean, this guy brings so much to the table.
Consistency, I'll put it this way.
Work ethic, offensive impact. Defensively, he's a lot better than Isaiah. So don't try to play that
card. I'll put it this way. Russell Westbrook is allegedly a top five player. Fine, whatever. People can say whatever they want. I would not want the Wizards to trade John Wall, who is not a top five player in anyone's eyes. I would not want a Wall for Westbrook trade. I wouldn't even want the Wizards to trade Bradley Beal for Russell Westbrook because I think he makes life so much more stressful for the rest of the roster. And
I sat through like 19 Wizards questions. I'm not going to allow you to try to tell me that Bradley Beal is better than Russell Westbrook.
It's just in terms of the rest of the team, he would be a pain in the ass to deal with for the other stars if you're trying to build a title team.
Oh, all right.
We've officially gone too far. So the unpopular opinion, it opened the door and I've officially taken it too far. So all I'm saying is that Russ is not a top five player.
I guess if the argument is a better pairing Wall Beal or Wall Westbrook? That's pretty redundant. But what about if you have the option of Westbrook and Beal?
I would rather have Wall and Beal. I don't even think that's even that hot of a take at this point. Wall is a better point guard than Russell Westbrook.
Oh boy, oh boy. Well, that's why it's the unpopular opinion. That's why we buried it this far. Hopefully nobody discovers this, doesn't make a headline out of it. I don't want to be associated with it. I'll take Westbrook over Wall. I think Wall doesn't get enough credit. I think there is something to what you're saying about, is he the most overrated? Because I think if people are automatically giving him the one or two spot in the MVP conversation, that's a mistake. Like, I don't think he just deserves that off the top. I think there's a lot of people in that combo. Well,
and he's putting up crazy numbers, but that's because he ran off Kevin Durant, and it's because he's basically, his game is such that the Thunder have had to build guys around him who don't know how to score and who are good at other things. So the Thunder have designed their entire team for Russell Westbrook to get triple doubles every night, which is great. And it's great if you want to get a seventh seed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't even know how well they've designed it for that purpose. It's just sort of like that's the only option they have. Hey, let's just wrap this up real quick. Let's plug Sam Anderson has a nice profile of Russell Westbrook in the New York Times Magazine. For all the Russell Westbrook fans who are incredibly angry by what Sharp said, go read that profile. It'll make you feel very good. it will be a balm for your scorched
thank
feelings.
You to everyone. Thank you to everyone who said questions. We've got a bunch more that we're going to have next week, and we will have some fun, and appreciate it to anyone who made it through to the unpopular opinion section of the pod. But we will be back next Tuesday.
I can't wait. All-Star is getting pretty close. That means trade deadline is getting pretty close. I'm guessing we're probably going to talk some trades next week. And it's
we'll
crazy
definitely
that
talk trades.
We didn't mention the Roy Hibbert blockbuster, you know?
Yeah, we didn't mention the blockbuster. You know what else we have next week, though, is Wizards-Cavs Monday night before our Tuesday podcast. So we'll recap that.
Another funeral.
I've tried to keep it pretty restrained, but if they beat the Cavs on Monday night, I'm going to be talking an unbearable amount of trash the next day. So look forward to that, or look forward to me eating crow after LeBron beats the Wizards by 20 Monday night. Either way, thank you for listening. We'll be back soon. Take it easy, Ben.
Peace.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.